but was I? Was that her spirit, or was it only my subconscious working it out? I wore the shirt from Paco the next morning as I hiked back to the PCT and on to Beldentown, catching glimpses of Lassen Peak as I went. It was about 50 miles to the north, a snowy volcanic mountain rising to 10,457 feet, a landmark to me not only because of its size and majesty, but because it was the first of the Peakside Pass in the Cascade Range, which I'd enter just north of Beldentown. From Lassen northward, the mountains of the High Cascades lined up in a rough row among hundreds of other less prominent mountains, each one marking the progress of my journey in the coming weeks. Each of those peaks seemed in my mind's eye to be like a set of monkey bars I'd swung on as a child. Every time I got to one, the next would be just out of reach. From Lassen Peak to Mount Shasta to Mount McLaughlin to Mount Thielson to the Three Sisters, south, middle, and north, to Mount Washington, to Three Finger Jack, to Mount Jefferson, and finally to Mount Hood, which I'd traverse 50-some miles before I reached the Bridge of the Gods. They were all volcanoes, ranging in elevation from a little under 8,000 to just over 14,000 feet. They were a small portion of the Pacific Ring of Fire, a 25,000-mile-long series of volcanoes and oceanic trenches that rim the Pacific Ocean in a horseshoe shape from Chile, up along the western edge of Central and North America, across to Russia and Japan, and down through Indonesia and New Zealand, before culminating in Antarctica. Down, down, down the trail went on my last full day of hiking in the Sierra Nevada. It was only 7 miles to Belden from Three Lakes, but the trail descended a merciless 4,000 feet in the space of 5 of them. By the time I reached Belden, my feet were injured in an entirely new way. The tips of my toes were blistered. They'd slid forward with each step, pressed relentlessly against the toe ends of my boots. This was supposed to be my easy day, but I dragged into Beldentown limping in agony, observing that, in fact, it wasn't a town. It was a rambling building near a railroad track. The building contained a bar and a small store, which also served as a post office, a tiny laundromat, and a shower house. I pulled off my boots on the store's porch, put my camp sandals on, and hobbled inside to collect my box. Soon I had my envelope with $20, the sight of it such a tremendous relief that I forgot about my toes for a minute. I bought 2 bottles of Snapple lemonade and returned to the porch to drink them, one after the other. "Cool shirt," a woman said. She had short, curly gray hair and a big white dog on a leash. "This is Odin." She bent to scratch his neck, then stood and pushed her little round glasses back into place on her nose and fixed me in her curious gaze. "Are you by chance hiking the PCT?" Her name was Trina. She was a 50-year-old high school English teacher from Colorado who'd begun her hike only a couple of days before. She'd left Beldentown hiking north on the PCT, only to be met by enough snow on the trail that she'd returned. Her report filled me with gloom. Would I ever escape the snow? As we talked, another hiker walked up, a woman named Stacy who had also begun her hike the day before, coming up the same road I had to reach Three Lakes. At last, I'd met some women on the trail. I was dumbfounded with relief as we exchanged in a flurry the quick details of our lives. Trina was an avid weekend backpacker, Stacy an experienced trekker who'd hiked the PCT with a friend from Mexico to Beldentown the previous summer. Stacy and I talked about the places on the trail we'd both been, about Ed in Kennedy Meadows, whom she'd met the summer before, and about her life in a desert town in Southern California, where she worked as a bookkeeper for her father's company and took her summers off to hike. She was 30 and from a big Irish family, pale, pretty, and black-haired. "Let's camp together for the night and make a plan," said Trina. "There's a spot over in that meadow." She pointed to a place visible from the store. We walked there and pitched our tents. I unpacked my box while Trina and Stacy talked on the grass. Waves of pleasure came over me as I picked up each item and held it instinctively to my nose. The pristine packets of Lipton noodles or dehydrated beans and rice that I ate for dinner. The still shiny Clif bars and immaculate Ziploc bags of dried fruit and nuts. I was sick to death of these things, but seeing them, new and unsullied, restored something in me. There was the fresh t-shirt I didn't need now that I had my Bob Marley shirt, two brand new pair of wool socks, and a copy of Margaret Drabble's A Summer Birdcage, which I wasn't quite ready for yet. I'd burned my way through only about half the pages of the novel, tossing them that morning into Paco's fire. And most important, a fresh supply of second skin. I took off my boots and sat down, doctoring my chawed-up feet. When Trina's dog began to bark, I looked up and saw a young man, blonde, blue-eyed, and lanky. I knew in an instant that he was a PCT hiker by the drag of his gait. His name was Brent, and once he introduced himself, I greeted him like an old friend, though I'd never met him. I'd heard stories about him back in Kennedy Meadows. He'd grown up in a small town in Montana, Greg, Albert, and Matt had told me. He'd once gone into a deli in a town near the trail in Southern California, ordered a sandwich with 2 pounds of roast beef in it, and eaten it in 6 bites. He laughed when I reminded him about it, and then he took his pack off and squatted down to get a closer look at my feet. "Your boots are too small," he said, echoing what Greg had told me back in Sierra City. I stared at him vacantly. My boots couldn't be too small. They were the only boots I had. "I think it was just all that descending from Three Lakes," I said. "But that's the point," replied Brent. "With the right size boots, you'd be able to descend without hashing up your feet. That's what boots are for, so you can descend." I thought of the good people of REI. I remembered the man who made me walk up and down a small wooden ramp in the store for just this reason, to make sure my toes didn't bang up against the ends of my boots when I went down, and that my heels didn't rub against the backs when I went up. They hadn't seemed to in the store. There was no question now that I'd been wrong, or that my feet had grown, or that there was any denying that as long as I had these boots on my feet, I was in a living hell. But there was nothing to be done. I didn't have the money to buy a new pair or any place to do it if I did. I put on my camp sandals and walked back to the store where I paid $1 to take a shower and dressed in my rain gear while my clothes washed and dried in the 2-machine laundromat. I called Lisa while I waited and was elated when she answered the phone. We talked about her life and I told her what I could convey of mine. Together we went over my new itinerary. After we hung up, I signed the PCT hiker register and scanned it to see when Greg had passed through. His name wasn't there. It seemed impossible that he was behind me. "Have you heard anything about Greg?" I asked Brent when I returned wearing my clean clothes.
"He dropped out because of the snow."
I looked at him, stunned. "Are you sure?"
"That's what the Australians told me. Did you ever meet them?"
I shook my head.
"They're a married couple on their honeymoon. They decided to ditch the PCT too. They took off to go hike the AT instead."
It was only once I decided to hike the PCT that I learned about the AT, the Appalachian Trail, the far more popular and developed cousin of the PCT. Both were designated National Scenic Trails in 1968. The AT is 2,175 miles long, approximately 500 miles shorter than the PCT, and follows the crest of the Appalachian Mountains from Georgia to Maine.
"Did Greg go to the AT too?" I squeaked.
"Nah, he didn't want to keep missing so much of the trail, doing all these bypasses and taking alternate routes. So he's coming back to hike it next year instead. That's what the Australians told me anyway."
"Wow," I said, feeling sick at the news. Greg had been a talisman for me since the day I met him in the very hour I'd decided to quit. He'd believed that if he could do this, I could too. And now he was gone.
So were the Australians, a pair I'd never met, but a picture of them formed instantly in my mind anyway.
I knew, without knowing, that they were buff and Amazonian, dazzlingly fit for the rugged outdoors by virtue of their Australian blood in ways I would never be.
"Why aren't you going to hike the AT instead?" I asked, worried he'd reveal that in fact he was.
He thought about it for a while. "Too much traffic," he said.
He continued looking at me, at Bob Marley's face so big on my chest, as if he had more to say.
"That's a seriously awesome shirt, by the way." I'd never set foot on the AT, but I'd heard much about it from the guys at Kennedy Meadows. It was the PCT's closest kin, and yet also its opposite in many ways. About 2,000 people set out to thru-hike the AT each summer, and though only a couple hundred of them made it all the way, that was far more than the 100 or so who set out on the PCT each year. Hikers on the AT spent most nights camping in or near group shelters that existed along the trail. On the AT, resupply stops were closer together, and more of them were in real towns, unlike those along the PCT, which often consisted of nothing but a post office and a bar or tiny store. I imagine the Australian honeymooners on the AT now, eating cheeseburgers and guzzling beer in a pub a couple of miles from the trail, sleeping by night under a wooden roof. They'd probably been given trail names by their fellow hikers, another practice that was far more common on the AT than on the PCT. Though we had a way of naming people, too. Half the time that Greg, Matt, and Albert had talked about Brent, they'd referred to him as the kid, though he was only a few years younger than me. Greg had been occasionally called the statistician, because he knew so many facts and figures about the trail, and he worked as an accountant. Matt and Albert were the Eagle Scouts, and Doug and Tom the preppies. I didn't think I'd been dubbed anything, but I got the sinking feeling that if I had, I didn't want to know what it was. Trina, Stacy, Brent, and I ate dinner in the bar that adjoined the Belden store that evening. After paying for a shower, laundry, the Snapple, and a few snacks and incidentals, I had about $14 left. I ordered a green salad and a plate of fries, the two items on the menu that both were cheap and satisfied my deepest cravings, which veered in opposite directions, fresh and deep-fried. Together, they cost me $5, so now I had $9 left to get me all the way to my next box. It was 134 miles away at MacArthur Burney Falls Memorial State Park, which had a concessionaire store that allowed PCT hikers to use it as a resupply stop. I drank my ice water miserably while the others sipped their beers. As we ate, we discussed the section ahead. By all reports, long stretches of it were socked in. The handsome bartender overheard our conversation and approached to tell us that rumor had it that Lassen Volcanic National Park was still buried under 17 feet of snow. They were dynamiting the road so they could open it for even a short tourist season this year. "You want a drink?" he said to me, catching my eye. "On the house," he added when he saw my hesitation. He brought me a glass of cold Pinot Gris filled to the rim. When I sipped it, I felt instantly dizzy with pleasure, just as I had when I drank the Hawaiian screwdriver the night before. By the time we paid our bill, we'd decided that when we hiked away from Belden in the morning, we'd follow a combination of lower elevation jeep roads and the PCT for about 50 miles before hitchhiking a bypass of a socked-in section of the trail in Lassen Volcanic National Park, catching the PCT again at a place called Old Station. After we returned to our camp, I sat in my chair writing a letter to Joe on a piece of paper I'd torn from my journal. His birthday was approaching, and the wine had made me nostalgic for him. I remembered walking with him one night a year before with a miniskirt on and nothing underneath, and having sex with him against a stone wall in a private cove of a public park. I remembered the giddy surge of emotion I'd felt every time we scored another bit of heroin, and how the dye from his hair had stained my pillowcase blue. I didn't let myself write those things in the letter. I sat holding my pen, only thinking of them, and also of the things I could tell him about my time on the PCT. It seemed impossible to make him understand all that had happened in the months since I'd seen him in Portland. My memories of last summer felt as foreign to me as my description of this summer would likely seem to him. So instead, I mostly asked him a long list of questions, wondering how he was, what he was doing, who he was spending time with, and if he'd yet made the escape he'd alluded to in the postcard he'd sent me at Kennedy Meadows and gotten clean. I hoped he had. Not for me, but for him. I folded the letter and put it into an envelope that Trina had given me. I picked a few wildflowers from the meadow and pressed them inside before sealing the envelope shut. I'm going to mail this, I said to the others, and followed the light of my headlamp over the grass and along the dirt path to the mailbox outside the shuttered store. Hey, good-looking, a man's voice called to me after I put the letter in the box. I saw only the burning end of a cigarette on the dark porch. Hi, I answered uncertainly. It's me, the bartender, the man said, stepping forward into the faint light so I could see his face. How'd you like your wine? He asked. Oh, hi, yeah, that was really nice of you, thanks. I'm still working, he said, flicking the ash of his cigarette into a planter. But I'll be off in a bit. My trailer's just across the way if you want to come over and party. I can get a whole bottle of that Pinot Gris you liked. Thanks, I said, but I've got to get up early and hike in the morning. He took another drag of his cigarette, the end burning brightly. I'd watched him a bit after he'd brought me the wine. I guessed he was 30. He looked good in his jeans. Why shouldn't I go with him? Well, you've got time to think about it if you change your mind, he said. I've got to hike 19 miles tomorrow, I replied, as if that meant anything to him. You could sleep at my place, he said. I'd give you my bed. I could sleep on the couch if you wanted. I bet a bed would feel good after you've been sleeping on the ground. I'm all set up over there, I gestured toward the meadow. I walked back to my camp feeling queasy, equal parts flustered and flattered by his interest, a shot of bald desire quaking through me. The women had zipped themselves into their tents for the night by the time I returned, but Brent was still awake, standing in the dark, gazing up at the stars. Beautiful, huh? I whispered, gazing up with him. As I did so, it occurred to me that I'd not cried once since I'd set foot on the trail. How could that be? After all the crying I'd done, it seemed impossible that it was true, but it was. I almost burst into tears with the realization, but I laughed instead. What's so funny? Brent asked. Nothing. I looked at my watch. It was 10:15. I'm usually sound asleep by now. Me too, said Brent. But I'm wide awake tonight. It's 'cause we're so excited to be in town, he said. We both laughed. I'd been savoring the company of the women all day, grateful for the kinds of conversation that I'd seldom had since starting the PCT. But it was Brent I felt oddly the closest to, if only because he felt familiar. As I stood next to him, I realized he reminded me of my brother, who, in spite of our distance, I loved more than anyone. We should make a wish, I said to Brent. Don't you have to wait till you see a shooting star? He asked. Traditionally, yes, but we can make up new rules, I said. Like, I want boots that don't hurt my feet. You're not supposed to say it out loud, he said, exasperated. It's like blowing out your birthday candles. You can't tell anyone what your wish is. Now it's not going to come true. Your feet are totally fucked. Not necessarily, I said indignantly, though I felt sick with the knowledge that he was right. Okay, I made mine. Now it's your turn, he said. I stared at a star, but my mind only went from one thing to the next. How early are you taking off tomorrow? I asked. At first light. Me too, I said. I didn't want to say goodbye to him the next morning. Trina, Stacy, and I had decided to hike and camp together the next couple of days, but Brent hiked faster than us, which meant he'd go on alone. So did you make your wish? He asked. I'm still thinking. It's a good time to make one, he said. It's our last night in the Sierra Nevada. Goodbye, range of light, I said to the sky. You could wish for a horse, Brent said. Then you wouldn't have to worry about your feet. I looked at him in the dark. It was true. The PCT was open to both hikers and pack animals, though I hadn't yet encountered any horseback riders on the trail. I used to have a horse, I said, turning my gaze back to the sky. I had two, actually. Well then, you're lucky, he said. Not everyone gets a horse. We were silent together for several moments. I made my wish. Part 4. Wild. When I had no roof, I made audacity my roof. Robert Pinsky. Samurai Song. Never, never, never give up. Winston Churchill. Chapter 11. The Loo Out of Loo. I was standing by the side of the highway just outside the town of Chester, trying to hitch a ride, when a man driving a silver Chrysler LeBaron pulled over and got out. Over the past 50-some hours, I'd hiked 50 miles with Stacy and Trina and the dog from Beldentown to a place called Stover Camp, but we'd split up 10 minutes before when a couple in a Honda Civic had stopped, announcing that they only had room for two of us. "You go," we'd each said to the other. "No, you go," until I insisted, and Stacy and Trina got in, Odin lumbering behind them to sit wherever he could, while I assured them I'd be fine. And I would be fine, I thought, as the man who drove the Chrysler LeBaron made his way toward me on the gravel shoulder of the road, though I felt a sick flutter in my gut as I attempted to discern in the flash of a second what his intentions were. He looked like a nice enough guy, a few years older than me. He was a nice guy, I decided, when I glanced at the bumper of his car. On it, there was a green sticker that said, "Imagine World Peace." Has there ever been a serial killer who imagined world peace? "Hey there," I called amiably. I was holding the world's loudest whistle, my hand having traveled to it unconsciously over the top of Monster and around the nylon cord that dangled from my backpack's frame. I hadn't used the whistle since I'd seen that first bear on the trail, but ever since then, I had a constant and visceral awareness of where it was in relation to me, as if it weren't only attached to my backpack by a cord, but another invisible cord attached it to me. "Good morning," the man said, and held his hand out to shake mine, his brown hair flopping over his eyes. He told me his name was Jimmy Carter, no relation, and that he couldn't give me a ride because there was no room in his car. I looked and saw it was true. Every inch except the driver's seat was crammed with newspapers, books, clothes, soda cans, and a jumble of other things that came up all the way to the windows. He wondered instead if he could talk to me. He said he was a reporter for a publication called The Hobo Times. He drove around the country interviewing folks who lived the hobo life. "I'm not a hobo," I said amused. "I'm a long-distance hiker." I let go of the whistle and extended my arm toward the road, jabbing my upright thumb at a passing van. "I'm hiking the Pacific Crest Trail," I explained, glancing at him, wishing he'd get in his car and drive away. I needed to catch two rides on two different highways to get to Old Station, and he wasn't helping the cause. I was filthy, and my clothes were even filthier, but I was still a woman alone. Jimmy Carter's presence complicated things, altered the picture from the vantage point of the drivers passing by. I remembered how long I'd had to stand by the side of the road when I'd been trying to get to Sierra City with Greg. With Jimmy Carter beside me, no one was going to stop. "So how long have you been out on the road?" he asked, pulling a pen and a long, narrow reporter's notebook from the back pocket of his thin corduroy pants. His hair was shaggy and unwashed. His bangs concealed, then revealed his dark eyes, depending on how the wind blew. He struck me as someone who had a PhD in something airy and indescribable. The history of consciousness, perhaps, or comparative studies in discourse and society. "I told you, I'm not on the road," I said and laughed. Eager as I was to get a ride, I couldn't help but feel a little delighted by Jimmy Carter's company. "I'm hiking the Pacific Crest Trail," I repeated, gesturing by way of elaboration to the woods that edged up near the road, though in fact the PCT was about 9 miles west of where we stood. He stared at me blankly, uncomprehending. It was mid-morning and hot already, the kind of day that would be scorching by noon. I wondered if he could smell me. I was past the point where I could smell myself. I took a step back and dropped my hitchhiking arm in surrender. When it came to getting a ride, until he left, I was screwed. "It's a national scenic trail," I offered, but he only continued looking at me with a patient expression on his face, his unmarked notebook in his hand. As I explained to him what the PCT was and what I was doing on it, I saw that Jimmy Carter wasn't bad-looking. I wondered if he had any food in his car.
"So if you're hiking a wilderness trail, what are you doing here?" he asked.
I told him about bypassing the deep snow in Lassen Volcanic National Park.
"How long have you been out on the road?"
"I've been on the trail about a month," I said, and watched as he wrote this down. It occurred to me that maybe I was perhaps a tiny bit of a hobo, given all the time I'd spent hitchhiking and bypassing, but I didn't think it wise to mention that.
"How many nights have you slept with a roof over your head in that month?" he asked.
3 times, I answered, after thinking about it. 1 night at Frank and Annette's and 1 night each at the motels in Ridgecrest and Sierra City.
"Is this all you have?" he asked, nodding to my backpack and ski pole.
"Yeah. I mean, I have some things in storage, too, but for now, this is it." I put my hand on Monster. It felt like a friend always, but even more so in the company of Jimmy Carter.
"Well, then I'd say you're a hobo," he said happily, and asked me to spell my first and last names.
I did, and then wished I hadn't.
"No fucking way," he exclaimed, when he had it all down on the page. "Is that really your name?"
"Yeah," I said, and turned away as if searching for a car so he wouldn't read the hesitation on my face. It was eerily silent until a logging truck came around the bend and roared by, oblivious to my imploring thumb.
"So," Jimmy Carter said after the truck passed, "we could say you're an actual stray."
"I wouldn't say that," I stammered. "Being a hobo and being a hiker are two entirely different things." I looped my wrist into the pink strap of my ski pole and scraped the dirt with the tip, making a line that went nowhere. "I'm not a hiker in the way you might think of a hiker," I explained. "I'm more like an expert hiker. I hike 15 to 20 miles a day, day after day, up and down mountains, far away from roads or people or anything, often going days without seeing another person."
"Maybe you should do a story on that instead."
He glanced up at me from his notebook, his hair blowing extravagantly across his pale face. He seemed like so many people I knew. I wondered if I seemed that way to him.
"I hardly ever meet hobo women," he half-whispered, as if confiding a secret. "So this is fucking cool."
"I'm not a hobo," I insisted more vehemently this time.
"Hobo women are hard to find," he persisted.
I told him that this was because women were too oppressed to be hobos, that most likely all the women who wanted to be hobos were holed up in some house with a gaggle of children to raise, children who'd been fathered by hobo men who'd hit the road.
"Oh, I see," he said. "You're a feminist, then?"
"Yes," I said. It felt good to agree on something.
"My favorite," he said, and wrote in his notebook without saying his favorite what.
"But none of this matters," I exclaimed, "because I myself am not a hobo. This is totally legit, you know, what I'm doing. I'm not the only one hiking the PCT. People do this. Have you ever heard of the Appalachian Trail? It's like that, only out west." I stood watching him write what seemed like more words than I'd spoken.
"I'd like to get a picture of you," Jimmy Carter said. He reached into his car and pulled out a camera. "That's a cool shirt, by the way. I love Bob Marley. And I like your bracelet, too. A lot of hobos are non-vets, you know."
I looked down at William J. Crockett's name on my wrist.
"Smile," he said, and snapped a shot.
He told me to look for his piece on me in the fall issue of the Hobo Times, as if I were a regular reader.
"Articles have been excerpted in Harper's," he added.
"Harper's?" I asked, dumbfounded.
"Yeah, it's this magazine that..."
"I know what Harper's is," I interrupted sharply. "And I don't want to be in Harper's, or rather, I really want to be in Harper's, but not because I'm a hobo."
"I thought you weren't a hobo," he said, and turned to open the trunk of his car.
"Well, I'm not, so it would be a really bad idea to be in Harper's, which means you probably shouldn't even write the article because..."
"Standard issue hobo care package," he said, turning to give me a can of cold Budweiser beer and a plastic grocery bag weighed down with a handful of items at its bottom.
"But I'm not a hobo," I echoed for the last time, with less fervor than I had before, afraid he'd finally believe me and take the standard issue hobo care package away.
"Thanks for the interview," he said, and shut the trunk.
Stay safe out here.
Yeah, you too, I said.
You have a gun, I assume. At least I hope you do.
I shrugged, unwilling to commit either way.
Because I know you've been south of here, but now you're going north, which means you're soon entering Bigfoot country.
Bigfoot?
Yeah. You know, Sasquatch, no lie. From here all the way up to the border and into Oregon, you're in the territory where most of the Bigfoot sightings in the world are reported.
He turned to the trees as if one might come barreling out at us.
A lot of folks believe in them. A lot of hobo folks. Folks who are out here. Folks who know. I hear Bigfoot stories all the time.
Well, I'm okay, I think. At least so far, I said and laughed, though my stomach did a little somersault. In the weeks preceding my hike on the PCT, when I decided not to be afraid of anything, I'd been thinking about bears and snakes and mountain lions and strange people I met along the way. I hadn't pondered hairy humanoid bipedal beasts.
But you're probably fine. I wouldn't worry. Chances are they'll leave you alone, especially if you have a gun.
Right, I nodded.
Good luck on your hike, he said, getting into his car.
Good luck finding hobos, I said, and waved as he drove away. I stood there for a while, letting cars pass without even trying to get them to give me a ride. I felt more alone than anyone in the whole wide world. The sun beat down on me hot, even through my hat. I wondered where Stacy and Trina were. The man who'd picked them up was only going to take them about 12 miles east to the junction of the next highway we needed to catch a ride on, which would take us north and then back west to Old Station, where we'd rejoin the PCT. We'd agreed to meet at that junction. I remotely regretted having encouraged them to leave me behind when that ride had come along. I jabbed my thumb at another car and realized only after it passed that it didn't look so good that I was holding a can of beer. I pressed its cool aluminum against my hot forehead and suddenly had the urge to drink it. Why shouldn't I? It would only get warm in my pack. I hoisted Monster onto my back and ambled through the weeds, down into the ditch, and then up again into the woods, which somehow felt like home to me, like the world that was mine in a way that the world of roads and towns and cars was no longer. I walked until I found a good spot in the shade. Then I sat down in the dirt and cracked the beer open. I didn't like beer. In fact, that Budweiser was the first whole beer I'd ever drunk in my life. But it tasted good to me, like beer tastes, I imagine, to those who love it, cold and sharp and crisp and right. While I drank it, I explored the contents of the plastic grocery bag. I took everything out and laid each item before me on the ground. A pack of peppermint gum, 3 individually wrapped wet wipes, a paper packet containing 2 aspirin, 6 butterscotch candies in translucent gold wrappers, a book of matches that said, "Thank you, Steinbeck Drug," a Slim Jim sausage sealed in its plastic vacuum world, a single cigarette in a cylindrical faux glass case, a disposable razor, and a short, fat can of baked beans. I ate the Slim Jim first, washing it down with the last of my Budweiser, and then the butterscotch candies. All 6 of them, one after the other, and then, still hungry, always hungry, turned my attention to the can of baked beans. I pried it open in tiny increments with the impossible can-opening device on my Swiss Army knife, and then, too lazy to rummage through my pack for my spoon, I scooped them out with the knife itself and ate them, hobo style, from the blade. I returned to the road feeling slightly hazy from the beer, chewing 2 pieces of the peppermint gum to sober up, while cheerfully stabbing my thumb at every vehicle that passed. After a few minutes, an old white Maverick pulled over. A woman sat in the driver's seat with a man beside her, and another man and a dog in the back seat.
"Where are you headed?" she asked.
"Old Station," I said, "or at least the junction of 36 and 44.
"That's on our way," she said,
and got out of the car, came around the back, and opened the trunk for me. She looked to be about 40. Her hair was frizzy and bleached blonde, her face puffy and pocked with old acne scars. She wore cutoffs and gold earrings in the shape of butterflies and a grayish halter top that seemed to have been made with the strings of a mop.
"That's quite a pack you got there, kiddo," she said, and laughed raucously.
"Thanks, thanks," I kept saying, wiping the sweat from my face as we worked together to cram Monster into the trunk. We got it in eventually, and I climbed into the back seat with the dog and the man. The dog was a husky, blue-eyed and gorgeous, standing on the tiny floor in front of the seat. The man was lean and about the same age as the woman, his dark hair woven into a thin braid. He wore a black leather vest without a shirt underneath and a red bandana tied biker style over the top of his head.
"Hi," I murmured in his direction, as I searched uselessly for the seatbelt that was crammed irretrievably into the fold of the seat, my eyes skimming his tattoos. A spiked metal ball on the end of a chain on one arm, and the top half of a bare-breasted woman with her head thrown back, in either pain or ecstasy, on the other. A Latin word I didn't know the meaning of scrawled across his tan chest. When I gave up on finding the seatbelt, the husky leaned over and licked my knee avidly with his soft and strangely cool tongue.
"That dog's got some motherfucking good taste in women," said the man. "His name's Stevie Ray," he added.
Instantly, the dog stopped licking me, closed his mouth up tight, and looked at me with his icy black-rimmed eyes, as if he knew he'd been introduced and wanted to be polite.
"I'm Spider. You already met Louise. She goes by Lou."
"Hey,"
Lou said, meeting my eyes for a second in the rearview mirror.
"And this here's my brother Dave," he said, gesturing to the man in the passenger seat.
"Hi," I said.
"How about you? You got a name?"
Dave turned to ask.
"Oh, yeah, sorry. I'm Cheryl," I smiled,
though I felt a blurry uncertainty about having accepted this particular ride. There was nothing to do about it now. We were already on our way, the hot wind blowing my hair. I petted Stevie Ray while assessing Spider in my peripheral vision.
"Thanks for picking me up," I said to conceal my unease.
"Hey, no problem, sister," Spider said.
On his middle finger, he wore a square turquoise ring.
"We've all been on the road before. We all know what it's like. I hitched last week, and motherfuck if I couldn't get a ride to save my life. So that's why when I saw you, I told Lou to stop. Motherfucking karma, you know?"
"Yeah," I said, reaching up to tuck my hair behind my ears. It felt as coarse and dry as straw.
"What you doing out on the road anyway?"
Lou asked from the front. I went into the whole PCT shebang, explaining about the trail and the record snowpack and the complicated way I had to hitchhike to get to Old Station. They listened with respectful, distant curiosity, all three of them lighting up cigarettes as I spoke. After I was done talking, Spider said,
"I've got a story for you, Cheryl. I think it's along the lines of what you're talking about. I was reading about animals a while back, and there was this motherfucking scientist in France back in the 30s or 40s or whenever the motherfuck it was, and he was trying to get apes to draw these pictures, to make art pictures, like the kinds of pictures in serious motherfucking paintings that you see in museums and shit. So the scientist keeps showing the apes these paintings and giving them charcoal pencils to draw with, and then one day, one of the apes finally draws something. But it's not the art pictures that it draws. What it draws is the bars of its own motherfucking cage. Its own motherfucking cage. Man, that's the truth, ain't it? I can relate to that, and I bet you can too, sister."
"I can," I said earnestly.
"We can all relate to that, man," said Dave,
and he turned in his seat so he and Spider could do a series of motorcycle blood brother hand jives in the air between them.
"You know something about this dog?" Spider asked me when they were done. "I got him the day Stevie Ray Vaughan died. That's how he got his motherfucking name."
"I love Stevie Ray," I said.
"You like Texas Flood?" Dave asked me.
"Yeah," I said, swooning at the thought of it.
"I got it right here," he said,
and pulled out a CD and placed it into the boombox that was propped between him and Lou. A moment later, the heaven of Vaughn's electric guitar filled the car. The music felt like sustenance to me, like food, like all the things I'd once taken for granted that had now become sources of ecstasy for me because I'd been denied them. I watched the trees stream past, lost in the song, Lovestruck Baby. When it ended, Lou said,
"We're lovestruck too, me and Dave. We're getting married next week."
"Congrats," I said.
"You wanna marry me, sweetheart?" Spider asked me, momentarily grazing my bare thigh with the back of his hand, his turquoise ring hard against me.
"Just ignore him," said Lou. "He's nothing but a horny old bastard."
She laughed and caught my eye in the rearview mirror. I was a horny old bastard, too, I thought, while Stevie Ray the dog licked my knee methodically, and the other Stevie Ray launched into a smoking rendition of Pride and Joy. The place on my leg where Spider had touched me seemed to pulse. I wished he'd do it again, though I knew that was ludicrous. A laminated card with a cross on it dangled from the stem of the rearview mirror, alongside a faded Christmas tree-shaped air freshener, and when it spun around, I saw that on the other side there was a photograph of a little boy. "Is that your son?" I asked Lou when the song ended, pointing to the mirror.
"That's my little Luke," she said, reaching to tap it.
"Is he going to be in the wedding?" I asked. But she made no reply. She only turned the music down low, and I knew instantly that I'd said the wrong thing.
"He died 5 years ago when he was 8, said Lou, a few moments later.
"I'm so sorry," I said. I leaned forward and patted her shoulder.
"He was riding his bike and he was hit by a truck," she said plainly. "He wasn't killed right away. He held on for a week in the hospital. None of the doctors could believe it, that he didn't die instantly."
"He was a tough little motherfucker," said Spider.
"He sure was," said Lou.
"Just like his mom," Dave said, grabbing Lou's knee.
"I'm so very sorry," I said again.
"I know you are," said Lou, before she turned the music up loud.
We drove without talking, listening to Vaughn's electric guitar wail its way through Texas flood, my heart clenching at the sound of it. A few minutes later, Lou shouted,
"Here's your junction."
She pulled over and shut the engine off and looked at Dave.
"Why don't you boys take Stevie Ray for a leak?"
They all got out with me and stood around lighting up cigarettes while I pulled my pack out of the trunk. Dave and Spider led Stevie Ray into the trees by the side of the road, and Lou and I stood in a patch of shade near the car while I buckled Monster on. She asked me if I had kids, how old I was, if I was married or ever had been. "No, 26, no, yes," I told her. She said,
"You're pretty, so you'll be okay whatever you do. Me, people always just gotta go on the fact that I'm good-hearted. I never did have the looks."
"That's not true," I said. "I think you're pretty."
"You do?"
she asked.
"Yeah," I said,
though pretty wasn't precisely how I would have described her.
"You do? Thanks. That's nice to hear. Usually Dave's the only one who thinks that."
She looked down at my legs.
"You need a shave, girl," she bellowed, then laughed in the same raucous way she had when she'd said how big my pack was.
"Nah," she said, blowing smoke from her mouth. "I'm just giving you shit.
I think it's neat you do what you want. Not enough chicks do that, if you ask me. Just tell society and their expectations to go fuck themselves. If more women did that, we'd be better off."
She took a drag and blew the smoke out in a hard line.
"Anyway, after all that stuff about my son getting killed, after that happened, I died too, inside."
She patted her chest with the hand that held the cigarette.
"I look the same, but I'm not the same in here. I mean, life goes on and all that crap. But Luke dying took it out of me. I try not to act like it, but it did. It took the Lou out of Lou. And I ain't getting it back. You know what I mean?"
"I do," I said, looking into her hazel eyes.
"I thought so," she said. "I had that feeling about you."
I said goodbye to them, crossed the intersection, and walked to the road that would take me to Old Station. The heat was so potent it rose in visible waves from the ground. When I got to the road, I saw three figures undulating in the distance.
"Stacy," I shouted. "Trina."
They saw me and waved their arms. Odin barked hello. Together we hitched a ride to Old Station, another tiny village that was more a gathering of buildings than a town. Trina walked to the post office to mail a few things home, while Stacy and I waited for her in the air-conditioned cafe, drinking soda pop and discussing the next section of the trail. It was a slice of the Modoc Plateau called Hat Creek Rim, desolate and famous for its lack of shade and water, a legendary stretch on a trail of legends. Dry and hot, it was scorched clean by a fire in 1987. The Pacific Crest Trail, Volume 1, California, informed me that although there was no reliable water source from Old Station to Rock Springs Creek 30 miles away, when the book went to print in 1989, the Forest Service was about to install a water tank near the ruins of an old fire lookout tower 15 miles in. The book cautioned that this information should be verified, and that even if it was installed, such tanks can't always be relied upon because of vandalism in the form of bullet holes. I sucked on the ice in my tumbler of soda one cube at a time, pondering this information. I ditched my dromedary bag back in Kennedy Meadows, since most sections of the trail north of there had adequate water. In anticipation of the Dry Hat Creek Rim, I'd planned to buy a large jug of water and strap it to Monster. But for reasons both financial and physical, I was hoping that wouldn't be necessary. I hoped to spend my last bits of money on food at that cafe rather than on a jug of water, not to mention the misery of carrying that jug for 30 miles across the rim. So I almost fell out of my chair in joy and relief when Trina returned from the post office with the news that southbound hikers had written in the trail register that the tank mentioned in the guidebook was there and that it had water in it. Exuberantly, we walked to a campground a mile away and set up our tents side by side for one last night together. Trina and Stacy were hiking out the next day, but I decided to lay over, wanting to hike alone again and also to rest my feet, which were still recovering from the blistering descent from Three Lakes. The next morning, when I woke, I had the campsite to myself. I sat at the picnic table and drank tea from my cooking pot while burning the last pages of the novel. The professor who'd scoffed about Michener had been right in some regards. He wasn't William Faulkner or Flannery O'Connor, but I'd been utterly absorbed in his book nonetheless, and not only for the writing. Its subject hit a chord in me. It was a story about many things, but it centered on the life of one novel, told from the perspectives of its author and editor, its critics and readers. Of all the things I'd done in my life, of all the versions of myself I'd lived out, there was one that had never changed. I was a writer. Someday I intended to write a novel of my own. I felt ashamed that I hadn't written one already. In the vision I'd had of myself 10 years before, I felt sure I'd have published my first book by now. I'd written several short stories and made a serious stab at a novel, but I wasn't anywhere close to having a book done. In the tumult of the past year, it seemed as if writing had left me forever. But as I hiked, I could feel that novel coming back to me, inserting its voice among the song fragments and advertising jingles in my mind. That morning in Old Station, as I ripped Michener's book into clumps of 5 and 10 pages so they would burn, crouching next to the fire ring in my campsite to set them aflame, I decided to begin. I had nothing but a long, hot day ahead of me anyway. So I sat at my picnic table and wrote until late afternoon. When I looked up, I saw that a chipmunk was chewing a hole in the mesh door of my tent in an attempt to get to my food bag inside. I chased it away, cursing it while it chattered at me from a tree. By then, the campground had filled in around me. Most of the picnic tables were now covered with coolers and Coleman stoves. Pickup trucks and campers were parked in the little paved pull-ins. I took my food bag out of my tent and carried it the mile back to the cafe where I'd sat with Trina and Stacy the afternoon before. I ordered a burger, not caring that I'd be spending almost all of my money. My next resupply box was at the state park in Burney Falls, 42 miles away, but I could get there in 2 days now that I was finally able to hike farther and faster,
I'd done 2 19-milers back-to-back out of Belden. It was 5 on a summer day when the lights stretched until 9 or 10, and I was the only customer, wolfing down my dinner. I left the restaurant with nothing more than some change in my pocket. I walked past a payphone, and then returned to it, picked up the receiver and pressed 0, my insides trembling with a mix of fear and excitement, when the operator came on to assist me in placing the call. I gave her Paul's number. He picked up on the 3rd ring. I was so overcome by the sound of his voice I could barely say hello.
"Cheryl," he exclaimed. "Paul," I said finally.
And then, in a fast jumble, I told him where I was and some of what I'd been through since I'd last seen him. We talked for close to an hour, our conversation loving and exuberant, supportive and kind. It didn't seem like he was my ex-husband. It seemed like he was my best friend. When I hung up, I looked down at my food bag on the ground. It was almost empty. Robin's egg blue and tubular, made of a treated material that felt like rubber. I lifted it up, pressed it against my body, and closed my eyes. I walked back to my camp and sat for a long time on my picnic table with a summer birdcage in my hands, too staggered with emotion to read. I watched the people make their dinners all around me, and then I watched the yellow sun melt into pink and orange and the softest lavender in the sky. I missed Paul. I missed my life. But I didn't want to go back to it either. That awful moment when Paul and I fell onto the floor after I told him the truth about my infidelities kept coming to me in waves. And I realized that what I'd started when I'd spoken those words hadn't led only to my divorce, but to this, to me sitting alone in Old Station, California, on a picnic table beneath the magnificent sky. I didn't feel sad or happy. I didn't feel proud or ashamed. I only felt that in spite of all the things I'd done wrong, in getting myself here, I'd done right. I went to Monster and took out the cigarette in the faux glass case that Jimmy Carter had given me earlier that day. I didn't smoke, but I broke the case open anyway, sat on top of the picnic table, and lit the cigarette. I'd been on the PCT for a little more than a month. It seemed like a long time, and also it seemed like my trip had just begun, like I was only now digging into whatever it was I was out here to do. Like I was still the woman with the hole in her heart, but the hole had gotten ever so infinitesimally smaller. I took a drag and blew the smoke from my mouth, remembering how I'd felt more alone than anyone in the whole wide world that morning after Jimmy Carter drove away. Maybe I was more alone than anyone in the whole wide world. Maybe that was okay. Chapter 12. This Far. I woke at first light, moving with precision as I broke camp. I could pack up in 5 minutes now, every item that had been in that unfathomable heap on the bed in the motel in Mojave that hadn't already been ditched or burned, had its place in or on my pack, and I knew exactly where that place was. My hands moved to it on instinct, seeming almost to bypass my brain. Monster was my world, my inanimate extra limb. Though its weight and size still confounded me, I'd come to accept that it was my burden to bear. I didn't feel myself in contradiction to it the way I had a month before. It wasn't me against it. We two were one. Bearing Monster's weight had changed me on the outside, too. My legs had become as hard as boulders, their muscles seemingly capable of anything, rippling beneath my thinning flesh in ways they never had. The patches on my hips and shoulders and tailbone that had repeatedly bled and scabbed over in the places where Monster's straps rubbed my body had finally surrendered, becoming rough and pocked, my flesh morphing into what I can only describe as a cross between tree bark and a dead chicken after it's been dipped in boiling water and plucked. My feet? Well, they were still entirely, unspeakably fucked.
My two big toes had never recovered from the beating they took on the merciless descent from Three Lakes to Beldentown. Their nails looked near dead. My pinky toes had been rubbed so raw, I wondered if they'd eventually just wear clean away from my feet. What seemed like permanent blisters covered the backs of my heels all the way up to my ankles. But I refused to think of my feet that morning in Old Station. So much of being able to hike the PCT depended upon mind control, the stout decision to move forward regardless. I covered my wounds with duct tape and second skin, then I put on my socks and boots and hobbled over to the campground spigot to fill up my two bottles with 64 ounces of water, which had to last me for 15 searing miles across Hat Creek Rim. It was early, but hot already, as I walked the road to the place where the PCT crossed it. I felt rested and strong, braced for the day. I spent the morning weaving my way through dry creek beds and bone-hard gullies, pausing to sip water as seldom as I could. By mid-morning, I was walking across a miles-wide escarpment, a high, dry field of weeds and wildflowers that offered barely a scrap of shade. The few trees I passed were dead, killed in the fire years before, their trunks scorched white or charred black, their branches broken and burnt into daggers. Their stark beauty bore down on me with a silent, anguished force as I passed them by. The blue sky was everywhere above me, the sun bright and unrelenting, scorching me even through my hat and the sunscreen I rubbed into my sweaty face and arms. I could see for miles, snowy Lassen Peak nearby to the south, and the higher and snowier Mount Shasta rising far to the north. The sight of Mount Shasta filled me with relief. I was going there. I would walk past it and beyond it, all the way to the Columbia River. Now that I'd escaped the snow, it seemed nothing could take me off course. An image of myself hiking with ease and alacrity through the rest of the miles formed in my mind, though the shimmering heat soon eradicated it, reminding me that I knew better. If I made it to the Oregon-Washington border, I knew it would only be with all the hardships that moving at foot speed beneath a monster of a pack entailed. Foot speed was a profoundly different way of moving through the world than my normal modes of travel. Miles weren't things that blazed dully past. They were long, intimate straggles of weeds and clumps of dirt, blades of grass and flowers that bent in the wind, trees that lumbered and screeched. They were the sound of my breath and my feet hitting the trail one step at a time, and the click of my ski pole. The PCT had taught me what a mile was. I was humble before each and every one. And humbler still that day on Hat Creek Rim, as the temperature moved from hot to hotter, the wind doing little more than whip the dust into swirls at my feet. It was during one such gust that I heard a sound more insistent than any caused by the wind, and realized that it was a rattlesnake, shaking its rattle hard and near, warning me off. I scrambled backwards and saw the snake a few steps ahead of me on the trail, its rattle held like a scolding finger slightly above its coiled body, its blunt face darting in my direction. If I'd taken another few steps, I'd have been upon it. It was the third rattlesnake I'd encountered on the trail. I made an almost comically wide arc around it and continued on. At midday, I found a narrow patch of shade and sat down to eat. I took my socks and boots off and reclined in the dirt to prop up my swollen and battered feet on my pack, as I almost always did on my lunch break. I stared at the sky, watching the hawks and eagles that soared in serene circles above me. But I couldn't quite relax. It wasn't only because of the rattlesnake. The landscape was barren enough that I could see for great distances, though I kept having the vague feeling that something lurked nearby, watching me, waiting to pounce. I sat up and scanned the terrain for mountain lions, then lay back down, telling myself that there was nothing to fear, before I quickly sat up again at what I thought was the snap of a branch. It was nothing, I told myself. I was not afraid. I reached for my water bottle and took a long drink.